Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests, the usual quota, lined up for today's show. First, in a few minutes, we'll speak with Ervand Abrahamian, who is a professor at Brew College at City University of New York. And he is an author of many books and articles on Iran, and most recently of a piece in the London Review of Books. I have not a speck of dirt. I am a retired teacher. He writes about the protests in Iran, but although Iran has somewhat fallen off the front pages, upstaged by Honduras and the death of, what's his name, Michael Jackson, that's his name, it is, of course, still simmering over there in a very important country, very important part of the world. So I want to get Ervand Abrahamian's perspective on what has been going on in Iran and what is likely to go on in the coming weeks and months. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined in the studio by Michael Thomas, who is a novelist, polemicist, political analyst, and he's got a new novel out called Love and Money, a novel. Do you want to ask Michael Thomas which of those two nouns gets the upper hand in that relation of love and money? This book just out from the excellent folks at Melville House Press. Before all that, some words on the economic news. More signs that the recession may be coming to an end. As I always say, may. The caveats and the qualifications, because this is an economic cycle like none other. Early in the week, we learned that the Conference Board's Index of Leading Indicators, which forecast changes in the direction of the U.S. economy 3 to 6 months out, rose for the third consecutive month in June. The index has now reversed nearly half of its fall over the three-year period ending in February, which is when it started to stabilize. All this suggests that we should start seeing some positive numbers in the major economic indicators starting in the fall, or at least before year-end. Again, caveat and qualifications must be added. Other signs of impending pickup include a rise in orders for new semiconductors in June, also the third consecutive monthly increase. Orders are up over 30% since hitting their low in March. Still, such orders remain quite depressed. They're now at half their level of last November and just about a fifth of the level of 2 years ago. But a rise is a rise, and better than a fall. And signs of an imminent bottom in housing continue to accumulate. Sales of existing houses rose by almost 4% in June, yet another instance of three consecutive months of increase. The rate of decline in house prices slowed a bit, too. This is a pattern with many things economic, a mix of modest improvements and slower rates of decline. But given the historical propensity of housing to lead the broad economy into and out of trouble, this is an encouraging sign. Yes, of course, I think the homeownership fetish is an economic waste and a social delusion. But until we see some sort of fundamental transformation in the structure of our economy, we have to see an economic recovery as better news than a recession. And as I've said, the recovery is likely to be weak, and the job market the last place to feel its pleasant breezes. But there are even signs of improvement in the job market, at least in the indicators I quote here every week, the jobless claims numbers. First-time applications for unemployment insurance filed by people who have just lost their jobs rose by 30,000 last week, following the previous week's 45,000 decline. But as I said then, that decline was probably exaggerated by the difficulties of adjusting for the July 4th holiday and changing patterns in seasonal layoffs in the auto industry. So the facts that the initial claims are still 15,000 below where they were 2 weeks earlier, and that the four-week average is down 93,000 from its peak in mid-April suggest that the pace of layoffs is really, really slowing. And in some other good news, the number of people continuing to draw unemployment insurance benefits fell by 88,000 from the previous week, and is down over 700,000. Down almost 700,000 over the last 2 weeks. That's really cheering. The continuing claims measure had been very sticky, refusing to follow its cousin, the initial claims series, down, which had been suggesting that while job losses were ebbing, there was still no hiring. Now that the continuing claims numbers are falling, maybe there is some hiring going on. Some of the decline in continuing claims is almost certainly the result of people running through their allotted time on the unemployment benefit rolls, but not all of it is a result of people running off those rolls. So, in the job market, things still kind of suck, but they're sucking a little less now. Last week, I mentioned that Goldman Sachs had a great time of it in the second quarter, totally raking in the bucks. Part of the reason for that is that so many of their competitors had either disappeared, like Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers, or on hard times, like Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley reported on Wednesday that it had a terrible spring quarter, losing $159 million, far more than Wall Street analysts had expected. Many financial pundits attributed the contrast in results between Goldman and Morgan to Goldman's courage in taking big risks in its own trading accounts compared to Morgan's relative caution. This is pretty funny when you think about it. Capitalists and their apologists always love to talk about profit as a reward for risk. But let's think about this for a moment. Finance took big risks with its own money and everyone else's for the last few years, and then ended up driving the global economy off a cliff. They, and we, have been more or less rescued thanks to trillions in government and central bank emergency infusions. So who is really bearing the risk here? We know who's raking in the profits: Goldman and a few other strong surviving banks. But even Goldman wouldn't have survived without massive federal aid. It's yet another illustration of that old saw about the socialization of risk and the privatization of profit. Nice work if you can get it. Okay, let's take a musical break. And that was some of the second movement of Beethoven's Sonata No. 18 for piano, Die Jagd, The Hunt, just like Jägermeister, for those of you who are keeping track of such things, that performed by Alfred Brendel. And we're now joined on the phone by Ervand Avrahamian, who teaches at Baruch College of City University, New York, and is the author most recently of an essay in the London Review of Books, July 23rd issue. I am not a speck of dirt. I am a retired teacher about the protests in Iran. Welcome to Behind the News, Ervand Avrahamian.
Hi.
So tell us about that title. I am not a speck of dirt. I am a retired teacher. What's that come from?
It's actually one of the most, I think, potent images of the demonstration, that big demonstration that was held after the election in Azadi Square, Freedom Square. It's about 1 million people were there. There was one picture that's really stuck out, was an old man carrying a sign saying, I am not a speck of dirt, I'm a retired teacher. And the reason that quote was there, he had the sign up, was Ahmadinejad, after the elections, had dismissed the opposition as saying there was just a speck of dirt, i.e. they were not consequential. So when 1 million people demonstrated, this was a way of showing that they were not just a speck of dirt.
Some people on the Western left have dismissed the demonstrations as the outburst of a bunch of neoliberals, privileged people, stooges of American imperialism. What's your opinion? Who constitutes those demonstrators?
Well, I think that's, again, why the sign was so potent. It a lot of people, like the person carrying it, they were also saying, we're not just privileged people, we're just ordinary folk. Teachers, in fact, were supposed to be the bulwark of Ahmadinejad's support, but the teacher salaries had been increased. But the fact was, inflation had also hit them very badly. So the general image that it's actually upper class or middle class opposition to Ahmadinejad, and Ahmadinejad has the support of the poor, is actually a myth. What you do have is hardcore Ahmadinejad support is about 20-25% of the population, and I would call that the evangelical support. And much of that is, of course, poorer classes.
That's about the same proportion we have in the United States.
Yes, it's actually, that's why I brought up the figure. It's actually a mirror image of the United States. But again, in the United States, no one in the left would say, well, they're going to vote Republican and support the Republican Party because a lot of people in the Bible Belt support the Republicans. So in Iran, it's very similar. There is a hardcore of evangelical support for Ahmadinejad, but that's only a small percentage. Most of the working class and the peasantry in the countryside actually voted, I would estimate, voted against Ahmadinejad. The trade unions all were voting for Mousavi. And the eyewitness accounts we have from the countryside also indicate that there the Ahmadinejad support was about 25%. The most of villages were supporting either Mousavi or Karoubi.
Now, what about that fundamentalist, the 20 to 25% of the population? Who are they demographically and geographically?
It cuts across, and I think it's basically, on the whole, could be people who are really tied to the regime in terms of members of the Basij. And also what you have is large quasi-state foundations led by clerics. And they actually control a significant part of the economy. They provide work contracts and so on. And they will often give benefits to people who are true believers, evangelicals. So if you are working class poor and you are a true believer, you can join the Basij and you get benefits like a motorcycle and access to university and so on. So that you have economic benefits that encourage evangelical support.
And those are the people who are riding around on their motorcycles beating up protesters.
Yes, yes.
Now, what about the other 75% or 80% of the population? What is their attitude towards the lock that the theocrats have on state power?
Not actually, I wouldn't say they're so much against the regime, because once you say a theocracy, who's saying they're, you know, somehow placing their whole republic as a theocracy. The republic is much more complex. There's a republican or democratic aspect of the state, which elections make it important. You have elections for the president, for parliament, indirect elections even for the supreme leader. So people, even if they're not in favor of a clerical dictatorship, they still can support the republic because there's enough room for democracy. But the danger now is that if elections are now meaningless, people then are going to really resent that and withdraw support from the republic, so that you end up with the state that has that 25% evangelical support, but 75% of the population is either actively or passively in opposition.
Yeah, I didn't mean to suggest it was a theocracy in a literal sense, but they're a mix. It's a mix of a democratic republican structure and theocracy. Certainly, the clerical elite has considerable control over who gets to run for office.
Yes, and that's of course where reformers want to do, what they want to do is not really abolish that power, but to open it up much more.
And in the run-up to the election, there was a poll that got some attention that said that, Terror-Free Tomorrow, Center for Public Opinion, they had a poll, which some people have seized on since, suggesting that Ahmadinejad was going to, had a pretty substantial base of support, and that this would refute any claims the elections were stolen in any sense. What about that poll and what it said?
Well, the poll, I'm not going to do sort of who are the people behind the poll, because it, as the title says, it's somewhat of a dubious organization in Washington. But what it did show was before the election, Ahmadinejad would have won. And that's probably a reflection of reality. But what the poll doesn't indicate is the great shift that took place during the campaign. The Iranian elections are limited very much by time. And often you get a great deal of fluidity because there are no established political parties. So it's quite feasible that the poll was true at the time it was taken.
But it also showed a large number of undecided people.
Yes, of course. When you have 50% undecided, that 50% could quickly swing towards Mosavi. And the people who took the poll actually did admit that it could have been very much out of date by the time the election did take place. But the apologists for the regime constantly actually harp on this poll, not mentioning who the poll takers were. And there was a lot of other questions in the poll which the poll takers were really interested in, which was that the vast majority of people who did respond actually wanted better relations with the United States. They also wanted more elections in Iran. They wanted free elections and so on. These were all basically things that wouldn't really support the Ahmadinejad point of view.
Now let's talk a bit about Ahmadinejad's record in office during his first term. He gets a lot of credit in some circles as a populist, a redistributionist, a friend of the poor. What shape has the economy taken under his reign, a period which included a sharp run-up in the price of oil, which meant that the state's coffers should have been quite full?
Yes, I mean, what he's been really, his Achilles heel has been actually the mismanagement of the economy. The argument both all the three opposition candidates used was here, Iran was basically swimming with money, unprecedented price rise in oil prices and oil revenue. And this was really squandered. And instead of creating work and jump-starting the economy, it was sort of handed out here and there without really serious planning. And the economic institutes that were really actually responsible for planning were either marginalized or actually disbanded because they didn't toe the line with Ahmadinejad. So Ahmadinejad he won the election in 2005, promising that he was going to really improve the standard of living and narrow the gap between rich and poor. But that really was not fulfilled. And that's actually why in the countryside so many people were pissed off and voted against him.
And the economic stats coming out of Iran are not there's an element of fiction mixed in with the with their measurement of reality, isn't there?
Well, the people who were actually responsible for picking figures out, which in Iran actually were quite reliable, that institute was disbanded. And they've used different criteria. And Ahmadinejad changed the criterion of who was unemployed and so on. Things, of course, that this is also done in the United States. You change the category to make the results look better. And in the election campaign, what the opposition candidates were showed in the debates was that he was playing loose with the figures. And, in fact, the joke in the streets of Tehran was that Ahmadinejad had a Pinocchio's nose because he was basically lying on economic figures.
So the campaign you talk about, the televised debates, actually had a tremendous influence on people's thinking in the weeks before the election, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is incredible because the whole country is now really linked to television. And it's estimated almost every household watched the debates. So that also makes the country a true nation rather than different provinces. So I think that everyone glued to the television watching the same debates really resulted in a sort of national mood shifting very quickly.
I should say I'm speaking with Ervand Abrahamian, who teaches at Baruch College, City University of New York, and has a piece in the July 23rd issue of the London Review of Books about the Iranian elections and the subsequent protests. What happened in those debates that really changed people's minds?
Well, one thing that the regime expected was that, of course, the candidates would go after each other. What happened, in fact, was the three opposition candidates then focused their targets on Ahmadinejad. So he was basically attacked from all sides. And their focus was really on the main issue was the economic issue, which, of course, hit people very directly. It was something that people were concerned. But other issues also were raised that, in a way, indirectly linked to bread and butter issues, which is foreign policy. Most Iranians realize that the economy can't really develop unless Iran develops its gas and oil resources. And to do that, they really need to improve relations with the West. And to improve relations with the West, they really have to deal with the United States. That doesn't mean normalize relations or be friendly with the United States, but to stop basically what the opposition candidate said, adventurous policies. The adventurous policies being sticking their fingers in the eye of the guerrilla, because the U.S. guerrilla, sort of people know, can be rather erratic and dangerous. So they want a more cautious foreign policy. And the opposition candidates, including the very conservative opposition candidate, Rezaei, were challenging Ahmadinejad on this issue, that he is going around the world basically making enemies, and that basically undermines Iran's national security.
How popular is the nuclear program?
Well, the nuclear program is very popular, but then the question is, what do you mean by nuclear program? I think people, Iranians who support the nuclear program, are talking about peaceful purposes, nuclear energy, nuclear technology. But if you then ask the question, nuclear program for nuclear weapons, then it's not that popular. But that's not often a question that's raised. It's a taboo question because the policy, or stated policy, is that Iran is not interested in nuclear weapons.
Do you believe that?
I believe that's the official policy, but I also suspect that some people like Ahmadinejad would like weaponization too. So that's another hidden, really, issue between the opposition and Ahmadinejad. It's actually a very serious issue, which I think some people realized it was there implicitly. It wasn't openly aired, but with Ahmadinejad as president, he will push for speeding up the nuclear program towards weaponization. And Mosavi and Karoubi were definitely not in favor of doing that, because they realized that would be a real confrontation with the United States and Israel.
And they would just rather not have that confrontation.
Yes, because for them the priority is economic development.
Speaking of economic development, and the economy is still very, very oil-centered, is there anything else going on, or is it just is oil really totally dominant?
It's still dominant. I mean, it's something that every government in Iran since 1951 has said, diversification. We're going not to rely so much on oil. We'll export other things. But after all, everything that is said, the result, the economic result, is that oil still dominates.
And that's not really good for the masses of people. I mean, if you're not spreading, the oil industry doesn't require that much labor, so what do people do for employment?
Well, it's mostly sort of construction, but it's not really goods that are exported. Mainly labor is quite expensive in Iran. Iran can't compete with places like China or India for cheap labor. So the alternative is really in terms of high tech, which Iran has a great deal of potential because its educational system is good. But to develop high tech and be plugged into the world's sort of globalized technical sphere, then, you need improved relations with the West.
Let's just shift to where we are right now. The government has, not completely successfully, but managed really to tamp down some of the protests. They've mobilized the security apparatus. What is the state of the population right now? Are people going to let Ahmadinejad have his way, or is this protest going to continue in the coming weeks and months?
Well, I don't expect sort of open protests because the penalties are high, broken heads, broken bones and so on. But other forms of protest in terms of petitions, passive resistance, if there are elections, people will stay home, and that actually is a great deal of threat to the state, because the state has always flattered itself on a great deal of popular participation. So if you had this time 85% participation, next time there's an election and the participation drops down to 50%. Now, for U.S. Comparison, that may not be too bad, but for Iranian elections, since the revolution, 50% would be a disaster.
Along those lines, the government did, at least coming into these elections, have a fairly high degree of legitimacy with the population, right?
Yes, and again, I think the republic still does. It's the question then of what sort of tendencies in the republic have popular support and which don't.
Now, we've been seeing fissures developing in the elite, a number of high-level people criticizing Ahmadinejad. And now, just the other day, he appointed as a vice president someone who said, we are friends of the Israeli people, which is now provoking further splits. What do you make of that?
That's, I think, a sort of storm in a teapot. That vice president is his son-in-law. Again, this shows that while he's talks populism and so on, he still practices nepotism like the other leaders. So if you have blood relatives or family members in key positions, that is good for you. So he wants his son-in-law as his vice president. And actually, the president in Iran, one place he can choose his own men is the vice presidency's. His ministers have to be okayed by parliament. But vice presidents, he can handpick.
But what about the broader question of the splits in the elite? How significant are those?
Some people see that as the sort of unraveling of the regime and showing that basically the days the writing is on the wall and so on. I don't see that because there have always been divisions among the top people. Sometimes those are then sort of smoothed over. Sometimes if people insist on opposition, they're marginalized. But it hasn't brought down the regime before, and I don't see that happening now, mainly because the people, the religious leaders, Ayatollahs, who are most vocal criticizing, they really don't have divisions. They don't have pastors. So the old saying, how many divisions does the Pope have, applies here. So someone like Rafsanjani might have a lot of prestige from the days of the revolution, but he doesn't actually control military contingents that he could use to threaten the central government. The military contingents are already wrapped up by Khamenei and Ahmadinejad. They basically have had 30 years to place their own people in key positions in the military.
We've only got about a minute left, but it seems like Ahmadinejad himself is really has a serious personal legitimacy problem, even if the overall regime, the overall system of governance does not. How can that be resolved? Can they just get him to shuffle off somehow, or how do you see this playing out?
Well, no, I can't see him being shuffled off, and I don't see him being diminished, because I think the reason he came out top in the election, but the supreme leader wanted him to win. And why did he want him to win? It's because I think they see eye to eye in foreign policy. So that in terms of challenge to United States, I think the supreme leader and the president are very much on the same page. So it doesn't portend very well for future U.S.-Iran relations, but I think that's the secret of Ahmadinejad's support.
All right, well, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Ervand Abrahamian, who teaches at Baruch College, City University of Newark, and has a piece in the July 23rd issue of the London Review of Books. I am not a speck of dirt. I'm a retired teacher. Okay, let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about love and money.
Hi, this is Cindy Lauper, and you're listening to WBAI.
Really got a hold on me.
Public radio. Gotta love it.
On WBAI 99.5 FM, the Caldwell Chronicle is on the air. I'm Earl Caldwell. Tune in for our broadcast every Friday, 3 to 5 p.m., right here on listener-supported Pacifica Radio in New York City.
And this is WBAI, not only at 99.5 in your FM dial in New York City, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And do visit that website. And if you do visit that website, please consider hitting the donate button. We're going to do a fundraiser pretty soon, but we could always use your cash. And things are looking up around here, so a little lift from your contributions would help us look even further up. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk with Michael Thomas.
The dreams you never told anyone, give me a break. Are you really a virgin who's never loved anyone else, or just a fake? Me, I don't know what to think anymore, don't know where to start. Just sit here with you and talk about nothing and breaking my heart. Question. Give me a smoke. What are you drinking? Is it a joke? Well, ain't it worth it? Or am I depraved? You hold your head high with one foot in the grave. Uh-huh.
And that a bit of Marianne Faithfull singing Love and Money from an album Kissing Time, which I believe came out in 2002. And we are now joined in the studio by Michael Thomas, who has a novel out with the same title, Love and Money, published by the fine folks at Melville House Books. Welcome to Behind the News, Michael.
Well, Doug, nice to see you again.
Hey, it's been a while. So Love and Money, which has the upper hand in that duo?
Well, I think one leads to the other. I mean, been married three times, an excess of enthusiasm for the former has led to a considerable departure from my life of the latter.
Yes, you write about a divorce attorney in this novel with, it seems like, considerable knowledge.
Well, I have inside knowledge of the most expensive and worst kind.
So, I've read about two-thirds of the novel. I have to admit that I didn't finish it, but it is very fine, and I do plan to finish it tonight. It's very nicely written and very absorbing and, as usual, full of insights not only about the immediate fictional realm, but the world we live in. Give the folks a little précis of what the novel's about.
Well, basically, it's about a woman who is a great TV figure, practically branded herself. I describe her as a combination of Martha and Oprah and Betty Crocker. And she does something foolish that puts the value of her brand in peril. And her principal sponsor has a huge amount of money riding on her, and she takes steps to see if she can correct the situation. And the woman's husband gets involved, and he consults a world-famous divorce lawyer to see what happens, and on it goes, and eventually ends up at the Supreme Court. Basically,
and with the Catholic Church involved.
Oh, you bet. Well, that actually goes back to, this is an anecdote I've told often, but it goes back to something that Cardinal Spellman, the late Cardinal Spellman, once said to my father. They were at some kind of reception, and he said, "Joe, I'm very sound on the liturgy, but I know everything about Manhattan real estate."
Well, yeah.
Because at that time, the church was, of course, the largest property owner in New York City. May still be.
Yeah, didn't they own the land under Rockefeller Center? Or
something? Right.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, Trinity Church up the street.
Sure.
Also a major. These guys, they didn't take any vows of poverty.
But basically, this book is about what most of my novels, of which this is the eighth, have been about, which is how people with the right resources, usually access and the money to buy the access, can manipulate the institutions which shape the lives of the rest of us, the law, legislatures, courts, media, markets, all of that. And you know, this is, I like to tell stories that illustrate that sad home truth.
Yes, as they say, was it illustrate but don't tell, right?
Right.
That's what they say in the fiction classes. Now, there's a temptation to say it's always been thus. You know, reading American history, it seems, you know, if we go back to the Gilded Age, Mark Hanna bought Congress with the equivalent of spending $1 billion in today's money. Is there something new in quality or quantity about that kind of monetary shaping that you're talking about?
This may be deeply personal, but it's really essentially new to me and people of my generation. You see, we grew up during World War II. And in World War II, people pretty much behaved themselves. And after the war, you know, we had Eisenhower as president and so on. And eventually, I think everything reverts to the mean or to the norm. And I think probably what we've seen over the last 20 years in this country is a reversion to what, if you read early accounts of the United States, I mean, if you go back to the Jacksonian era, you read Dickens's views of the United States when he visited it. But to someone whose youthful illusions and impressions were formed during the war, you know, when my father was in the Pacific for 4 years on carriers, we probably naively grew up thinking rather better of this country than, or its institutions, than the facts over the long run of American history.
Well, did you think at the time that maybe it had grown up and outgrown the bad habits of its adolescence?
Well, I think probably, but I suspect that people felt the same way, you know, who grew up at the time of the founders. I mean, talking to someone around 1800 would have given you a vastly different impression than, say, talking to someone around 1830.
Yeah, but I first became aware of your writing, I guess, when you had a column in Manhattan Inc. back, what, around 1987
right,
or so?
Yeah.
And that was really, you know, that was a time when the 80s were in full flower, and there was a sense that this was really a new order of new money and new personalities who are turning over all the established verities.
Well, I think what happened is that Wall Street eventually came to take over this country, and really that happened in the 80s. When I was growing up, for the longest time, for example, secretaries of the Treasury always came out of industry. They came out of the steel business or the automobile business or the airplane business. But in the last 25 years or so, they've all come from Wall Street. And I think that's a kind of an interesting indicator of the eventual shift to, or shift back to, if you will, of the economic power in this country to the figuratively the part of Manhattan that you and I are sitting in right now.
You spent some time yourself working on Wall Street.
I was a partner of Lehman Brothers, but that was back in the 60s. It was an era of some silliness, and it culminated in a kind of general collapse. But still, the business at that time was based largely on relationships. And, of course, the largest difference is that in the business at that time, we didn't have computers. What computers have made possible is to profitably trade ridiculously small fractions of money. And
at tremendous speed.
At tremendous speed and without the incursion of anything approaching judgment. Computers don't have emotions and they don't have judgment. And when they run the show entirely, as really seems to be what happened in the run-up to the credit crisis of last year, and certainly the present stock market, which, I mean, the rally is starting to look pretty real, but in its early stages seems to have been driven very heavily by computerized program trading, notably at Goldman Sachs.
Well, there's a certain kind of faux populism, I guess, that emerged around the same time that Michael Milken became a celebrity, that the old Wall Street you were just describing, that of relationships, which, you know, it mattered who was your roommate at St. Paul's, And now it's a matter of just how much money you can make. But that is, I think people say, you know, now this is a world of pure merit rather than pedigree. What do you say to that argument?
Well, I never thought much of the pedigree argument. Lehman Brothers, we had people who came, partners who came from every single walk of life. I think that this was the Milken myth was concocted essentially to suit the occasion, and it provided a nice story for the junk bond raids on large companies. But in the late 60s, we were doing the same thing on behalf of the conglomerators like Jimmy Ling and Scharfenberger and so on.
And of course,
these were not establishment people.
That great moralist Felix Roten got a lot of ink in the late 80s, early 90s for condemning that world, but he was enabling it himself, wasn't
he? Well, I've always said that Felix pounds the pulpit with the same hands that he uses to endorse the check.
Yeah, he endorsed lots of checks when he was putting together
IT&T. I mean, he's, you know, Felix is a very smart and a very admirable man, and the problem with working on Wall Street is that you have, in a sense, to serve two moral masters if you're going to keep doing it. I couldn't do it. But others can, and I suppose one says the more power to them.
Well, which moral masters are these two?
Well, one is, you know, essentially questions of right or wrong. Is this useful, what I'm doing? Is this helping anybody? What is the human cost of what I'm doing? All of those things versus how big is the fee involved? And most successful people on Wall Street are either utterly deficient in the first category, or they are able to come to terms with it and say, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make as much money as I can, and at the same time, I'm going to either be philanthropic or I am going to be philosophical and preach a little bit about it and pick the other guy to identify as the bad guy.
Or, of course, you can hope you make a bucket of money by the age of 40, then retire and do good afterwards with your money. Right?
Well, that seems to have been a model, yeah.
I'm speaking with Michael Thomas, who is author of now his eighth novel, Love and Money, just out from Melville House Books, but also commentator on the political economy of our time, which is a lot of rich material there.
Indeed, there is.
Now, when we had the credit crisis, you know, that we are now, more than a year and a half into this recession, 2 years into the credit crisis, I thought that old regime had finally met its match. And now here we see Goldman Sachs back on top of the world again. Well, what's your evaluation of this?
Well, I think that it goes back to what I said. I think that the way Washington was essentially set up, Wall Street is the center of the economic world as they envisage it there. And the decision was made to save Wall Street because it appeared that credit was going to lock up. Now, you go ask the average man in the street and you hear these horror stories about small businesses all around, and credit still seems to be locked up. But you had a Secretary of the Treasury who came from Wall Street. You had two secretaries of the Treasury, you have, people with Wall Street connections rather than industrial connections. The last secretary of the Treasury had who was an industrialist was Paul O'Neill in Bush's first administration, first term, and he spoke truth to liars and was promptly kicked out of the cabinet for his troubles. So I think the decision was made to bail out Wall Street, and this has been done, and it's been done in a way that I don't think one person in 100 understands in this country, which has provided some of these houses with profits that are just as good as they were making before the crash. Just as good. They have less competition. Spreads have widened because with less competition, what used to be underpriced can now be overpriced. It's terrific. And meanwhile, you know, there's another recession out there, which consists mostly of people who haven't got jobs or who've lost their jobs. I don't hear of a lot of new hiring even going on Wall Street with these numbers this way. I mean, these numbers are generated by computers, and you don't need a lot of people once you've got those programs in place.
Of course, as usual, Goldman seems almost in a class by itself. How do these guys pull it off?
Well, I'll tell you a story. I have a piece on the Daily Beast today, which you may not have seen, but I think this kind of summarizes it. In 1933 and 34, the Senate Committee on Banking and Currency instituted an investigation into what had gone on Wall Street leading to the 29 crash. The chief counsel for that committee was a man named Ferdinand Pecora, and his performance was so salutary, you might say, that those hearings have, which lasted roughly 14 months in the June of 34, are known as the Pecora hearings. Pecora wrote a book about it called Wall Street Under Oath, which was published in 1939, and I happen to have a copy. So the other day, I was reading it, and with great interest, and I mean all the big names on the street, Morgan, Chase, National City, Dylan Reed, were called down and hammered in public and embarrassed. And I'm reading this, Pecora's account, and I get, you know, about half the way through the book, and I say to myself, where the hell is Goldman Sachs in all this? Because they were as instrumental as anyone in pre-crash flim-flam. They had these pyramided investment companies called with names like Blue Ridge and Shenandoah, and then there was the famous Goldman Sachs Trading Company. But no mention. I go to the index, no mention of Goldman Sachs in Pecora's book. So last year it happened that there was published a massive authorized history of Goldman. So I got that out, and I looked in the index. Pecora is mentioned only once near the very end of that large 1,000-page book in connection with Boesky. So nothing. So I went back and I read about Goldman in 33 and 34. And guess what I found? The Pecora hearings were commenced in January of 33. Roosevelt was inaugurated in March of 33. Roosevelt's largest single fundraiser was Sidney Weinberg of Goldman Sachs. And in 1933, at the same time these hearings were going on, Roosevelt set up a commission which was supposed to allow businessmen to speak with assured dignity, quote unquote, in the White House. And the chairman of that commission, Sidney Weinberg of Goldman Sachs. And clearly, I envisaged this, as I said in this piece on Daily Beast, I envisaged Pecora going to the chairman of the Senate committee with Goldman on his subpoena list and being greeted with a thin smile and a shake of the head and a thumb jerked in the direction of the White House. And I think that there can't be really any other explanation, because they dragged all of them down there and put them through the ringer. And as you know, Eddie Cantor for years would be on stage doing his routine, and a guy would come on and say, send me $10,000, and Cantor would say, that's the man from Goldman Sachs.
Well, this is further evidence of what they call around Goldman, the ethic of public service. Right?
Well, I think that Goldman's greatest ability, considered as a firm, and this goes all the way back to my own experiences with them at the turn of the 70s when Gus Levy was the chairman, simultaneously chairman of Goldman Sachs, chief partner of Goldman Sachs and chairman of the New York Stock Exchange. Goldman has the most highly developed facility I have ever seen for being on every side of every deal.
And how do they do it? How can they do? How can nobody else do what they do?
Well, I think most other people probably assume it can't be done, and so they don't try. But I have seen this over and over again, and I think it's chutzpah, if you want a simple word for it. I think you simply figure this is the way we're going to do it, and let's set out to do it.
Well, and in the recent instance, of course, they were selling mortgage-backed securities and shorting them for their own account at the same time.
Right? Of course. Every side of every deal. It's if you take that kind of ability to carry two moral stools on each shoulder and exponentiate it, this is what we're talking about.
In the last few minutes we've got here, I do want to turn to a topic that interests me, which is the decline of the old WASP elite and the replacement by nothing, really, to speak of. There was a WASP elite that served as a kind of ruling class in this country for quite some time, an ethnically based, regionally based ruling class.
No. Actually, I'm a WASP, and, you know, family goes back to the Anne, which is the second boat that came after the Mayflower. The WASP elite was a set of values that essentially flowed from the muscular Christian education that was instituted in England in the course of the 19th century at places like Rugby by Dr. Arnold. And it was based on athleticism and stiff upper lip and the rest of that. In the last 20 years, the WASP elite has not so much disappeared. It's simply a leopard that changed its spots. As I said to a friend of mine a year or so ago, it's really interesting. All my Jewish friends want to be Episcopalians, and all my Episcopalian friends suddenly want to be Jewish. The guys that went to St. Paul's School and Harvard or Yale or wherever all are manning trading desks and trying to make just as much money and build just as big, ugly houses in the Hamptons. So it's not so much that the WASP elite vanished. It simply went somewhere else. It decided there was no more money in being the elite they were.
But one of those values you're talking about was a certain haughty disdain for commerce or commercial values. That, of course, seems very quaint in, after 25 or 30 years of rampant accumulation.
I think, Doug, that is essentially, it's something you project because it's a terrific screen to operate behind. You read Mr. Morgan's testimony, J.P. Morgan, the son, Jack Morgan's testimony to Pecora, and he projects that perfectly. And yet these guys want to cut your throat for $100,000. But it's a wonderful screen to operate behind. I mean, this is what business has really always been about.
But now we dispense with the screen, don't we?
Well, I think so. But, you know, we read Blankfein's statements, you know, as he talks about these things, and it's all about how they paid $1 billion back in TARP warrants the other day, and he said, you know, we're pleased to be able to add this money to the rebuilding effort. And this guy, this is a $5 or $6 or $10 trillion thing. A billion is nothing. It's all the rhetoric. The rhetoric is, you know, see what I say, but I'll do as I do.
All right, let's close by just a couple of words about the book. It's all about the brand, or that's the central.
Brand is the name of the game. You walk into, I'm a what they call condescendingly a mid-list author, but you watch people go into a Barnes & Noble and they're looking for the brand names they know, James Patterson, John Grisham, and so on. It's a confusing world with a lot of choices, and it's again gotten much larger in that way since the internet came along. And so brands are important, and brands have undoubted value. I mean, look at what people say Coca-Cola, the brand, is worth.
Well, they're the new religion.
Have a brand. It stands for something. And people recognize it. You know, that's what we're all trying to do.
I wish I could monetize my brand more effectively.
Well, we all do, but then we wouldn't be doing what we do.
That's true. All right. Well, thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Michael Thomas, who is the prolific polemicist and novelist and author, most recently of the book Love and Money, a novel just published by Melville House Books, which is, of course, also a brand, but one based in Dumbo. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this oldie but goodie from Lou Reed. Not at all relevant to what we've been talking about at all, but I've always loved this song, Wild Child. Till next week, bye. Out.